Today's Teisho will be on case 29 in the Umenkwan, the Mumonkan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 29 is entitled The Sixth Ancestors, Your Mind Moves. The wind was flapping a temple flag, and two monks started an argument. One said the flag moved. The other said the wind moved. They argued back and forth, but could not reach a conclusion. The sixth ancestor said, "It is not the wind that moves. It is not the flag that moves. It is your mind that moves." The two monks were awestruck. Mumon's comment, "It is not the wind that moves, it is not the flag that moves, it is not the mind that moves. How do you see the ancestor? If you come to understand this matter deeply, you will see that the two monks got gold when buying iron. The patriarch could not withhold his compassion and courted disgrace." Mumon's verse, wind, flag, mind moving, all equally to blame, only knowing how to open his mouth, unaware of his fault in talking. The main figure in this koan is Wei Nang, the sixth ancestor. The Zen tradition is based upon what's called transmission from teacher to student, personal transmission. So in India, following the Buddha, there were the Buddha had many awakened followers, and those followers practiced with other people, and those people had awakening experiences, and then they had students, and then their students had students, and so on. And one of the students of students of students of students of students of the Buddha was a man named Bodhidharma, Bodhidharma. And Bodhidharma brought his particular approach to Buddhist practice, which we call the Chan or Zen, to China from India. And Bodhidharma had really three students, two men and a woman. And those students actually had students who had students who had students. But the main Zen lineage is often thought to go through the Bodhidharma through six particular people, and the last of those, or five particular people, and the last of those is called the sixth ancestor. That's Wei Nang. And Wei Nang was basically an illiterate woodcutter who was able to become deeply awake, and he became the leader of one of the major schools of Zen practice, and so he's a great hero of the Zen tradition. In this koan, we're at his temple, and he's walking maybe through the courtyard. And at this time, around temples, they had flags. This is not so different from like you've seen maybe Tibetan prayer flags. But around temples at this time, they would have had flags, some kinds of banners. Sometimes they used to put up a flag when Sesshin was going on. That would be a signal to people that they weren't supposed to approach the temple, or if they were in a temple that was near a lot of houses, it was sort of like asking people to be quiet so everybody could concentrate. So it's probably not Sesshin because the monks are talking. And everybody knows you shouldn't talk at Sesshin. So the monks are, the wind was flapping a temple flag, and two monks started an argument. One said the flag moved, and the other said the wind moved. They argued back and forth but couldn't reach a conclusion. So anyway, Wei Nang is crossing through the courtyard and he overhears this. He says, it's not the wind that moves, it's not the flag that moves, it's your mind that moves. I think this is a really wonderful koan, and it's especially appropriate for this time in I guess you could say, history. Because some of you may have been following over the last couple of weeks the events of our economy. And you may may feel rather insulated from this. If you're rather young, it might not seem terribly important. If you're a little bit older and you're reasonably secure in your life, it might not seem terribly important. But what's happened over the last month or so is pretty amazing. If you've been reading the papers, the United States economy has had some serious setbacks. And basically our housing market has gone very steeply downhill. So houses that were valued at very high levels, say houses that were valued at $800,000 might be worth $500,000 now, and houses that were worth $200,000 might be worth $140,000 now. This happens all the time, but it's happened on such a huge scale, and lots of people are in trouble because they borrowed money hoping that they would be able to sell their houses at a profit. And this has happened to literally millions of people. So I myself have seen this happen. We bought our house something like 15 years ago over in Plainfield. And at that time, we were looking for a house that would be suitable for Sesshin with a small group of people. So we found a house that had four bathrooms, which is quite an achievement, you know. And it looked like it was going to work out, you know. And the house was pretty run down, and at that time, this was in the 90s, the housing market had dipped then too. And housing values had, houses had lost a lot of their value. People on the street where we bought the house had lost like $50,000 of value in their homes. So they had paid $200,000 maybe, and the house was now worth $150,000. And the house we bought was worth about $160,000 at the time. That's what we paid for it. And 2 years ago, our next-door neighbors, Fidel and Keith, sold their house, which is almost identical to ours, for $500,000. So they bought their house also for about $150,000 and sold it for $500,000. And so everybody wanted to get a house, right, and make $350,000 off their investment. So people were eager to buy houses and eager to sell them for much more money. And they assumed that their houses were going to make a lot of money, and so they borrowed lots of money, as they figured that they could borrow a lot of money because their house was going to appreciate. And so many people got deeply in debt, borrowing on their equity in their houses, assuming that everything was going to be fine. There are even shows on television about how you can make lots of money buying a house and selling it. There's a place called Trading Spaces, show called Trading Spaces. Sometimes I come home at night after sitting and my wife is watching Trading Spaces, and it's all about people who buy a house, you fix the roof, you paint the rooms, you change the toilets in the house, and you can sell it for $100,000 more, basically. This is the game. You know, you put in a new bathroom, and it shows here's what you put in, here's your profit. And so everybody in the country is thinking, I will be able to fix my house up and sell it and make a lot of money, and we'll all be gloriously rich and secure. But what happened was that at some point there were really too many houses were built for the market, and people kept trying to sell their houses for higher and higher prices. And finally everybody realized, wait, there are way too many houses on the market, and they're very overvalued, and they suddenly couldn't sell their houses. Nobody wanted to buy houses at such a high price. And so as housing values declined, many people found that they were paying more for their houses than their houses were worth. So some people bought a house for $500,000, and now the house is worth maybe $350,000, see? And so they're paying more than the house is worth. And some people were hoping that they could sell their house, and now they can't, and they can't make the payments on their house. Well, this isn't supposed to be a lesson in finance, you know, so I hope I'm not driving you crazy. But this is sort of how people, think, right? We have all kinds of plans and expectations about how life is supposed to turn out. And we have all kinds of dreams, all of us. I do, everybody does. Actually, when we bought the house in Plainfield, part of the plan was eventually to sell it for much more money and use it to maybe buy buy a building to be a Zen center. So I was guilty of this too, you know. And everybody gets excited about this sort of thing, you know. It's like everybody's making money. When my neighbors came next door and said, we're selling our house for $500,000, I actually laughed. I thought that was great. It's like money falling out of the sky, you know. That's so great, right? Wow, you know, from 150 to $350,000 in 10 years. What a deal. Not only did all ordinary Americans, borrow lots of money thinking their houses would increase in value, but big financial institutions assumed that they were going to make a lot of money by buying the mortgages for all these houses. So they thought these houses were all going to gain value. And so buying lots of houses, if you were a bank or a finance company, was an incredibly smart thing to do because the sky was the limit. Money was like falling out of the sky. And if you could just buy enough houses, they were going to go up and up and up. If you bought the mortgage today for $300,000, who knows? You know, it could be worth $1 million in no time. Anyway, all over the world this went on. People were buying American mortgages or buying American real estate. And then the value of the real estate, everybody sort of realized, wait a minute, these houses aren't worth this much. These houses aren't worth it because they couldn't sell them. Suddenly nobody wanted to buy a house that used to be worth $150,000. Nobody wanted to buy it now for $500,000. And so what we're watching is every month housing values are dropping. So if this process goes on, pretty soon our house will be worth, you know, it was $500,000, then it was $400,000, then it'll be $300,000. Pretty soon it'll be down to $150,000 or maybe $160,000 again. It'll be back to the original price. It probably won't go quite that low, but this is a terrifying for everybody because everybody counted on the future to deliver wealth. And we were sure we understood what the future was going to look like, you know? This is so human, right? All of us count on things, on our ability to plan and project into the future. And it's basic human quality. But again and again, we're disappointed by events because they don't always turn out the way we planned. When I was a little boy, TV had been around for only about maybe 10 years, maybe 10 or 15, 10 years. Believe it or not, when I was a little boy, TV was like new technology. Now, computers have been around longer than TV had been around when I was a little boy. In fact, there were still people who had TVs that were very big TVs with little 6-inch screens. Yeah, my grandmother had one of the first TVs, and it was a big box, but the screen was only 6 inches wide. It took all this stuff just to make this little picture. So, when I was a little boy, I used to watch TV, and it was this new technology. And there were a lot of like comedians on. And one of the standard punchlines was when you would watch a comedian, one way to get a laugh was to talk about some product that didn't work. So he would be talking about a camera. He got a cheap camera and it didn't work, and he'd turn it over and underneath it said "Made in Japan." Right? And "Made in Japan" was like you could just have to say that and people would laugh because it was about it always said cheap and no good, right? So when I was a boy, if something was made in Japan, always people thought, "Oh, that's no good. That's a cheap product." You know? So today, you know, everybody understands that Japanese products are really wonderful, very high quality. Nobody could have predicted that someday it would be a joke all over the world. They turn the product over and it would say "Made in USA," right? And they go, "Oh, that's too cheap and poorly made," right? And they say, "Made, now let's get a product that's made in Japan, right? Reliable, right?" See, this is how life works. It just works this way. We want it, you know, obviously it's frightening to think about this, you know, the kind of uncontrollability of events. It's the uncontrollable. In fact, many people find this like deeply terrifying, right? In fact, maybe this is one of the biggest fears people have, you know, is the uncontrollability of events. Again, you know, when I was a little boy, the United States was the wealthiest country in the world, and it had the highest standard of living. In fact, when we were in school, one of the things we were always told was, our country has the highest standard of living. We didn't know what that meant, you know, but we went around saying it. You still hear people saying that, even though it's no longer true. Actually, many countries have a higher standard of living than the United States. In the 50s and 60s, when I was very little, if you had said the United States is going to have a major financial meltdown 50 years from now, people would have laughed. They would have said, that's impossible. That's impossible. We have economists. They're not going to let that happen, you know. We understand the finance, you know. This happens all the time. Because reality is actually like open, very open-ended. It just is. It's a little scary. But it's very difficult to predict the future because probably it's unpredictable. I mean, totally. What I mean by that is that, you know, we imagine that we can figure out, if we're just smart enough and we know enough, we can have a clear and certain knowledge of the future. We believe that, you know. But actually, you know, one of the things scientists say is that the universe is really not fixed in that way. It's not really predictable in that way. It's like governed by probabilities, actually. So chance is actually a huge part of life. Probabilities, right? And even though something's highly improbable, it could still happen. See, that's a remarkable thing about the universe, is that something could be totally improbable, but it can still happen. Even if there's 1 in 100 chance, the next thing that happens could be, even if an event has a 1 in 100 chance of happening, the next event that happens could be that event. So actually, probably, no matter, you know, we could build this like super computer that was super smart, and we might be able to program it with all the knowledge we've got, you know, but it still might not be able to predict the future, because the future may really be open. You know, it may be really open, unpredictable, you know. And actually, that's what people say. You know, that's many scientists say the universe is really like probabilistic universe, not a predictable universe. This is learning to sort of like live with this or be comfortable with this. I think is very difficult, but it's very, very important if you want to be happy. If you want to be happy, you have to sort of like take the universe on its own terms, you know. I think that means having a different attitude towards events. It's very difficult, but you know, if you look at the financial meltdown that's happening, you can see, if you work backward, how it happened. So right now, there's all these people who are looking at how did this happen, right? And they're looking at the step one in this process, step two in this process, step three. When you look back over it, you see this was so, this now looks so predictable, right? It's like, oh my God, why didn't we see it? Why didn't we see it? What fools we were, right? But actually, probably things could have turned out quite differently, you know. You know, when you look back over your life, if you look back over the events of your life, it might seem like everything that happened had to happen. You know, it just was like lockstep. I made this decision and this happened. I made this decision and this happened. But actually, you know, life is very open-ended. It really is. You know, I have a friend of mine who wanted to be a doctor. His parents wanted him to be a doctor. And he really wanted to be like a research scientist. And he went to medical school and he got his degree, and probably when he was going to medical school, he really thought he wanted to be a doctor. And it was something he dreamed about. You know, he was his aspiration, it was his dream, and so on and so on. But actually, when he got to be a doctor, he was very unhappy. And he eventually became like a research scientist, not a doctor. If you had asked him 10 years before, you know, what do you want to be? He said, doctor. I know I'll be happy if I'm a doctor. When he got to that place, he wasn't particularly happy. So, I mean, it's just possible that even though we need to plan out our future, the future we're planning isn't going to happen as we planned it. You know, I bet you that's how it works out. Yeah. And a lot of things are going to happen that you didn't foresee, or that we didn't foresee. And how we respond to those events is very, very important if we want to be happy. You know? I think it's quite important to have a kind of strategy for dealing with life. You know, when things go unexpectedly, you can respond in a lot of different ways. You know, one of the ways you can respond is with fear, or another way is with anger. Another way is with disappointment and bitterness. Another way is self-loathing. You know, these might all be very familiar emotions to you. Many people are quite disappointed by life. You know, actually. And they're quite sort of angry that it hasn't gone the way they planned. So my feeling is that trying to live in that way is not a very productive or happy existence, right? It's very important to have plans and to have goals and to have dreams. You know, that's part of human life. It takes a lot of energy to achieve anything in life. It just takes, you have to sort of formulate an ideal or an image of what you want to achieve, right? So started graduate school in English, you know, I thought maybe it might work out that I was going to get a PhD and be an English professor, you know. And so I was training at the Seattle Zen Center, and I was taking courses graduate studies in English. And it took a lot of work to get a PhD in English. And English, you might not think, is that hard as a discipline. All we do is read books, right? But actually, we've made it very hard to get a PhD in English. You know? So you have to read all this stuff that's very difficult to understand, and it's pressure, actually, very high pressure. Writing a dissertation is very difficult. Every day you sit down and you're doing something you don't know how to do, and you don't know where it's going to go, and you try to get your graduate supervisor to help you, but he or she is in Europe, and you won't read your stuff, you know. And it's difficult. You read these books, and one book says it's this way, and another book says it's this way, and it's confusing. And if you can understand the books at all, they don't agree, you know. And then you sit down to write, and you think, well, what do I believe? And you write something, and you realize it contradicts itself, and then you, you know, you cry, and you go back and revise, and this goes on and on, you know. So you have to sort of have the ability to, like, to commit yourself to a project, and you have to have a kind of, you have to be able to generate a kind of, you know, determination. I think that's important, being able to have determination. Nothing can be accomplished without a kind of, it's like a kind of a goal, forming a goal. You start to pursue that goal, and if you encounter resistance, you don't give up. You keep going, you know. And it's like building up your muscles, sort of. You know, you formulate a goal or a vision or a desired outcome, and then you pursue it. And when things don't go your way, you don't just fold up. You keep going. And I think that's very noble. I think that's a very good characteristic. If you can develop that kind of determination, that's great. But the truth is, you know, that often life is uncontrollable, even when we try to live that way, you know. So for example, I started graduate school. I was sort of interested in it, but I loved my Zen practice, and I just didn't want to keep moving furniture or working in a kitchen, which just wasn't where I wanted to be. So I went to graduate school, and I worked very hard. And the more time I put into this, the more it became, it was challenging. But, you know, I kept pushing and trying, and sometimes I'd succeed and sometimes I'd fail. And finally I got my PhD. And I went out on the job market, and it was 1984. And we had an economic downturn, by the way, around then. And there were very few jobs in English that year. And in fact, in 1984, I didn't get a job. I wrote like 100 job letters. And those were, by the way, that was before computers, you know. Really, I used to have to type them. So I would type like 10 letters a day, and mail them out. And I had like 100 letters, and I kept track of all the places I'd written to, and I sent 100 letters out, and I would get like 98 no thank yous back, right? And then I got a few what they call interviews. I went for a few interviews, but I didn't get the job. So I had spent 7 years getting my degree and no job. Yeah. And that was very painful, you know. But that happens all the time. I was reading something the other day, and I'd seen this statistic before, but you know, the average engineer in the United States in his career or her career is fired 5 times. Isn't that interesting? Average engineer fired 5 times. And that's not because they're unsuccessful. It's because they're successful. If you're hired to like build a dam or something, and you're a hydraulic engineer, they hire you, and you do your job, and when it's done, they say, thank you very much, now you're fired, right? This goes on. I might have talked about this before, but you know, somebody actually did a study of heart attacks at NASA. And they found that when they sent up a successful space flight, there were more heart attacks than when it went wrong. And it was because all those engineers knew, I'm going to be fired next week. This was a big success. I'm done, you know. Now, you know, you have to form a kind of, it's like building up a kind of internal pressure. You form a dream, you build up a kind of internal pressure, you know, and you push, push, push. This is sort of how we live, right? You know, this is, but you know what? You can't control the outcome. You can't control the outcome. I think life is a little bit like getting into a plane that has no doesn't have a compass, right? You know, you just get into the plane and you take off, and then you're not ever sure where exactly you're going, you know. I think life is like that. It is important to have determination and not be thrown, not be knocked down by unexpected events, you know. But on the other hand, I think much of life is really like uncontrollable, not just for you personally, but for the whole society. You know, the brightest people in America right now can't figure out how to get out of our economic problems. They really can't. And it's not because they're frauds, you know. It's because there is a kind of open-endedness to things, right? So I think it's very important to have a kind of strategy for dealing with this fact that life is not going to be the way we expect, or very rarely it's going to work out quite the way we expect. I think being able to sit on the cushion is really quite important, you know, because have a different relationship with events as they unfold, you know. I mean, normally we're trying all the time to like make things happen. I think this is inevitably the case, you know, we're trying to make things happen. So, I mean, I do this all day long. I write memos to people, and if they actually read the memo, they might do what I'm asking them to do, and something will happen, right? So we all do this, trying to make things happen. But, you know, if you practice Zen long enough, you realize that in a certain way, in a certain sense, you know, things are going to happen anyway. It's all right. You know, if you sit on the cushion and you watch your breath, eventually, you know, you have like a, well, you've probably noticed this, but if you watch your breath long enough, a self-consciousness sort of disappears. If you sit and you watch your breath, and you watch your breath, and you watch your breath, for a while there's a lot of thinking and self-awareness, but at some point you just start resting serenely in the moment, you know? And when you start resting serenely in the moment, the quality of the moment becomes very different. You know, you might come in and sit down on the cushion and think, I want to have a wonderful sit today. You know, I want to have a beautiful, blissful sit. And you sit down on the cushion and you begin to notice that there's, say, pain in your leg or something like that. Or maybe there's something that has been bothering you and it keeps coming up as you're sitting, you know. And you can get mad, you can get upset, you know, you can say, this is not the sit that I plan to have. This is not the meditation session that I plan to have. But if you don't get up and leave the room, at some point you're just going to start allowing your mind to move from moment to moment in a non-judgmental way, right? And if you stay in that state long enough, you begin to feel much better, much better. Now this can seem trivial, but it's quite important. This kind of impartial mind is, indispensable in your life toolkit, you know. The ability to stop trying to control events and to let them unfold naturally, it's amazingly liberating. And people who practice Zen have to sort of learn how to do it, or you'll stop practicing Zen. You know, Zen is all about being able to step outside of the small mind, the mind that tries to control and direct events, and to enter into this other kind of awareness, which is impartial awareness. And, you know, you're sitting on the cushion, and this moment comes, and you don't necessarily have a feeling about it, or a thought about it, or a response to it, you know. And then another moment comes, there's not really a feeling about it, or a response to it, you know, or an idea. And then another moment comes, but strangely, pretty soon, you might begin to feel a little more liberated. And if you do this a lot, you begin to feel like you're in the current. It's like, a current like a stream. That you're watching like a stream. It's this leaf is floating by, and this leaf is floating by, and this leaf is floating by, and it all has to go this way. You know, there's like a bigger life unfolding. And you're watching it unfold, and you have this sort of like neutral or non-judgmental mind. And it's tremendously liberating to be in that state. Tremendously liberating. In fact, you know, when you're feeling, ordinary mind isn't like this at all, right? Ordinary mind is constantly caught up in the flow of events, and it's constantly holding on or trying to stop and having all of these emotional reactions. So, you know, as this event is happening, you might think, this is not what I wanted to have happen, you know? So it just generates tremendous tension, fear, anger, anxiety, you know? Or disappointment, right? And then we go on to the next moment. It's the same thing, you know. A classic example of this might be, maybe this hasn't happened to you, but I myself have had some terrible dates in my life, right? You know, just like terrible, you know. I was a typical American teenager. Well, maybe people don't have dates anymore, I don't know, but back in the 60s and the early 70s, you actually asked somebody, you said, do you want to go on a date? And that usually meant you went to like the movies or something, right? Or, you know, do you want to go on a date? And you might go to a party, or you might go to a movie or something. And just everything that could go wrong would go wrong for, like, in my teenage mind, right? You know? So, you know, basically, I would, you know, be ready the morning of the day when I was taking somebody on a date, I'd get up and I'd look in the mirror, and my face would be all broken out. I wanted to be suave and sophisticated. I didn't want to have acne, you know. And then, you know, I would pick up the person and try to, you know, be clever or entertaining, or, you know, and I just, everything I would say would fall flat. You know, say something, what do you mean by that? You know, or, I don't understand what you're talking about, you know. Well, that's strange, or, you know. And you tell a joke and the person doesn't laugh, you know. Or, you know, you're talking about something and they have a totally different response, but you've already indicated how you feel, and then they're defensive. And, you know. And then you go to a movie and you know, wasn't that a great movie? No, I thought it stunk, you know, and you know, that sort of thing. So I've had countless dates like that, and, you know, you start with such high hopes, right? This is going to be a wonderful experience. You know, I'm going to come in and I'll have a clear complexion and say, oh, hello, you know, I never realized your eyes, you know, they're golden color, you know. And, you know, we go to the movies and we talk and we, oh, that's fascinating, you know. I love it that you're such a reader, you know. You're so interested in books. That's great, you know. And we talk about books and then we go to the movie and say, oh, that was great. You know, Bergman is a great director, don't you think, you know. And, yes, you know. You know, and naturally, when I was, you wanted something, you go, oh, you know so much about movies. How wonderful, you know. And it doesn't go like that. You know, you say something and it falls flat, and then you start, I would get nervous, right? And, you know, sometimes by the time these dates were over, I was just so glad to be out of it. You know, I was just like, thank God, you know. That was horrible. You know, how do you come home and your mother would say, how was the date? Oh, it's okay, but I realized, thank God, it's horrible, you know. Never wanted to see that person again, you know. And in my high school, you just sort of like, oh, hello, you know. And actually, they were usually giving me the brush off, so I wasn't giving them the brush off. But, you know, when an event like that happens, you have a dream of how it's supposed to go, right? And then it starts deviating from your dream. And the more it deviates, you know, the more helpless you become and sort of like nervous. And when you're worried about whether something's going to work out, you can very seldom do a good job, right? You know, I realize now I should have just tried to have a good time and be like a good host on these dates. I should have just thought, well, you know, if I'm, you know, just what would you like to do? You know, that would be a good question, something I never ask people. You know, what would you like to do? You know? And what would make you happy? And what's interesting to you? You know, and just, you know, just go with the, as I said, go with the flow, right? You know, and I was so trying to control the situation, and the other person must have felt very controlled by me, you know, and of course when things weren't going that way, I would get tense and rigid. And if I just said, look, this is the day, I'm just going to spend some time with this person. I don't know anything about this person. Why don't I just try to learn something about this person and try to do what I can to make sure we both have a decent time, have an entertaining time, or at least not a painful time. I would have been so much happier. But it was my image of how things were supposed to go. I was so invested in that I got tenser and tenser and more rigid. And of course, you worry, you know, and then afterwards you analyze endlessly, right? You go, oh my God, why did I say that? That was so stupid, right? You know, of course, what a schmuck I am, you know? And if I had just not cared so much about it all and just let it unfold, I would have had a better time, and probably the poor people I invited on these things would have had a better time too. Letting go and having like impartial mind is not part of ordinary consciousness. It's not. So the more time you spend in ordinary consciousness, the harder it's going to be to achieve this impartial mind. So, you know, I know people who get up in the morning and the first thing they do is get onto the internet. And they read alternet.com and some of the other sort of journals online, and it's like immediately the first thing they do is turn on the internet, and it feels like a slap in the face, right? You know, Bush, you know, what's he done now? You know, and they just, oh my God, and this is outrageous, you know, and it's just article after, this is scuff, those, you know, just. Sputtering, you know, and it makes that's one way to live, right? You know, that's one way to live, and especially if you listen to like talk radio, please don't. But if you do, you listen to people like Rush Limbaugh. They're incredibly angry all the time, right? And if you are into like left-wing journalism, also there's this like this incredible undercurrent of anger, frustration, disappointment, you know. And that's definitely a way to live, but that's like ordinary mind. If you spend more time on the cushion, you spend more time in this impartial, this kind of non-judgmental mind. It's just dwelling calmly in the moment, right? And it's more important than ever when this mind is more, needs to be cultivated on a regular basis. If you try to cultivate it in the middle of a crisis, you won't be able to cultivate it. Right? So when you're not in crisis, you know, do a lot of zazen. And then when a crisis arises, you really need this impartial mind. And when you're in that impartial mind, you can respond to events in a more creative and generous way, right? Because you're not trying to control the outcome. You know, you're not trying to control the outcome. Look, the financial collapse is going to happen, you know, and America might actually go into like a major recession or even a depression. And, you know, it might actually happen that a lot of, you know, this last month America lost 500,000 jobs in 1 month. So, you know, basically it might happen that we have lots of millions of Americans can't find work. And you know, I hope this doesn't happen, but some people in this room could be in that category. Now, you know, if that happens to you, you can get very upset, you can get angry, you can hate yourself and blame yourself. But look, if you have a recession, it's not your fault you lost your job, right? You didn't. Or, you know, if you can find this impartial mind, if you can find this impartial mind and spend some time there, you know, you can have a wonderful life even when life doesn't go the way you planned. And it's never going to go the way you planned. So cultivating this mind that doesn't have expectations, that doesn't judge, and it is, I think, it's just the most wonderful way to live. You know, and it's hard, of course, when you're in the middle of a crisis. So if you've made a friend out of this kind of awareness, if you've spent a lot of time with your impartial mind, when things really go crashing down around you, you don't have to hold on to them. You don't. You know, the world can be going crazy all around you. You don't have to participate in that madness. You can just, you know, you can let it swirl around you, but you can be going forward in this with this beautiful, calm mind, this imperturbable, calm mind. And it's not a fantasy. This is something you can achieve in your life, and I think it's the most important thing you can have. You know, I'll wrap it up, but during the Great Depression, one out of every four Americans was out of work. Isn't that amazing? Like almost 30% unemployment. And yet a lot of people blamed themselves. They developed alcohol problems. There was a lot of domestic violence, you know, all because people can't find this other mind. But, you know, on the other hand, there are these people you run into who have this kind of calm. And meeting people like that is so precious because it reminds us we don't have to be caught up in the turmoil. Fear is like contagious. You know what I mean? It's contagious. It's why the economy is going down the tubes. Because everybody was sure they were going to make $1 million, and now everybody's sure they're going to be out on the street, you know. And this contagious atmosphere of fear, you turn on the TV, it's in the newspapers, it's on the internet, it's the end of the world, right? Every once in a while you meet somebody who's not caught up in that. you know, they have, they're able to find this calm place, and it's so reassuring, right? You don't have to live that way. You don't have to live that way. Every time you sit down on the cushion and you enter that impartial mind, you realize, you know, this moment is absolutely perfect. You know, what if I lose my job? Well, then I lose my job. And what if I lose my house? Then I lose my house. You know, this happens to all kinds of people. You know, and it's very hard. But if you just can live more of your life in impartial mind, when those moments happen, it'll be much easier to deal with them. And you know, actually, the secret, I think, to living a life creatively is not to be stymied by failure. You know, when we fail, you know, we think, well, that's it. You know, I've reached a dead end. I don't know what to do. And there's nothing that can be done. But if you can find that impartial mind, you realize, oh, there's all kinds of things that can be done now. You know, they're just not what I originally planned. They're just not what I originally thought. So, you know, the next year could be very challenging for people not only in the United States but all over the world, and it could be challenging for you personally. But please remember what I'm saying today, that you know, life never works out the way we planned, and the idea of control is really probably like a big illusion, as we're seeing right now. And so it's not really that smart or that good of an idea to try to live in the mind that tries to control, you know? I try to spend as much time I can in that that non-judgmental mind, you know? And I think it's really a wonderful place to be. The wind was flapping a temple flag, and two monks started an argument. One said the flag moved, and the other said the wind moved. So that's a judgmental mind, right? That's the clinging mind. And the sixth patriarch comes along and he says, you know, that's an unhappy way to live. You know, there's another kind of mind, the non-grasping mind. And the monks were awestruck. In other words, they're liberated. For just a moment, you know, for just a moment, they're set free from their expectations. And as soon as that happens, everything becomes very beautiful, very wonderful. You know, you could lose $1 million, but if you can get into impartial mind, next moment's going to be just like so beautiful. And if you don't believe me, just keep sitting. I promise you this is true. And if you believe me, keep sitting too.